The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to the 2017 Internal Medicine Board Review Course, sponsored by the American College of Osteopathic Internists. The course was held March 22nd through 26th, 2017, at the JW Marriott Las Vegas Resort and Spa. The course featured nationally known speakers presenting a wide variety of topics of interest to the internist preparing for certification or recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Acute coronary syndromes is presented by Dr. Asif Sarajan.
So for those of you who are on the floors, this is something that you've probably seen if you're dealing with internal medicine or cardiology, acute coronary syndrome patients, patients with chest pain. So I'm going to talk about what's relevant for the guidelines and what may be on your tests. So when we talk about acute coronary syndrome, we look at it as as I was talking about the peripheral arterial disease lecture, it's a progression of plaque that happens within the coronary vessels. When the vessel is occlusive, then you may have a patient with a stable angina. If it progresses very quickly, or if there may be thrombus involved, they may have an unstable angina and or non-ischiovation myocardial infarction. If they have an occlusive thrombus within a vessel, then it may be an ST elevation myocardial infarction. And that is the types of acute coronary syndrome. These are my disclosures. So the definitions of acute coronary syndrome: unstable angina, non-ST elevation myocardial infarction, and ST elevation myocardial infarction. Within the acute coronary syndrome, you can have no ST elevation. That's going to be your unstable angina or non-ST elevation myocardial infarction. ST elevation myocardial infarction can, most of the time, is going to be a Q-wave myocardial infarction, but sometimes it can be a non-Q-wave myocardial infarction. I think that distinction has become less now that we have quicker reperfusion times with PCI-capable hospitals. Many of these patients can be taken care of very quickly. And in our hospital, you know, we strive to get it at 60 minutes. We've changed from 90 minutes. But for your examination, our door-to-balloon time, you have to remember, is 90 minutes. So as the patient comes in, within 90 minutes, opening up that vessel. Now, if you're at a non-PCI-capable hospital, door-to-needle time should be less than 30 minutes. So door-to-needle meaning patients getting fibrinolytic therapy within 30 minutes. If you are going to a hospital, and you may have a question about this, if you have a patient going to a hospital that is PCI-capable and that hospital that the patient presented to is not PCI-capable, the door-in to door-out time within that first hospital should be within 30 minutes. So the patient should be transferred within 30 minutes. The total door-to-balloon time from the time of presentation to the time the artery is open should be 120 minutes. Now, we have gone beyond that. Nowadays, we're, you know, for the purpose of the examination, those are the numbers you need to know. But really, what we're starting to look at now is the total ischemia time from the time of onset of symptoms to the artery open of 120 minutes. But for the examination, the numbers you need to remember are the 30 minutes for the reperfusion with fibrinolytic therapy, 90 minutes for your door-to-balloon time, and 120 minutes if you are going to a PCI-capable hospital, from a non-PCI-capable hospital. So pathophysiology of acute coronary syndrome is that destabilization slash plaque rupture. So I tell my patients it's literally like a volcanic eruption within your artery. So there is a plaque that ruptures. There's thrombus formation within the vessel. If it's an occlusive thrombus, it will present as an ST elevation myocardial infarction. We've seen, you know, I've seen many cases where patient had an occluded right coronary artery and it wasn't a STEMI. But for the most part, for the examination, you have to remember that. So history, you're asking the typical questions. They may present to you with exertional symptoms that are becoming more and more frequent. Now they're happening at rest. That is an unstable angina patient, non-ST ovation myocardial infarction. Maybe a patient with resting chest discomfort. But remember, they may show you or they may tell you about a patient that has an atypical symptom. So in your diabetic patients, keep that in mind. Those patients will present with symptoms of, epigastric discomfort, arm pain, and so on. And we are looking at the cardiac biomarker in these patients. And then if they're positive, then obviously that's going to be a non-ST ovation myocardial infarction. Quality, onset, duration. And as I said, patients may present with heart failure. Women may present with, many times I've seen patients present with just fatigue. You're looking at their past cardiac history, coronary risk factors. Now, in your examination, they may have a patient that you are asked, how do you want to manage this patient? Maybe there's an acute coronary syndrome patient that is not a STEMI patient. So ST elevation myocardial infarction patient, pretty straightforward. That patient is going to be going to the cardiac catheterization lab. They may ask you some questions about what kind of medications would you want them to be on, and we can go through that. But for your other types of ACS patients, they may ask you, how would you want to treat this patient? So the things that you need to remember for that is looking at your TIMI risk scores. And the TIMI risk score is just a measure of the risk of future cardiac events. And patients with high TIMI risk score should go an interventional approach. So in general, you can look up this TIMI risk score, but these are your older patients over the age of 65 is one of the risk factors. Patients with previous cardiovascular disease risk factors. So they may tell you a patient who's a diabetic, previous history of coronary disease, family history of coronary disease, and if they have three of those risk factors, that is considered one risk factor. Dynamic EKG changes. So what they may show is a patient, initial EKG showed normal rhythm, and then subsequently an EKG shows deep T wave inversion in the anterior leads. Or ST depressions. That's a patient with a dynamic EKG changes. Cardiac biomarkers. So if their patient has elevated cardiac biomarkers, that's a risk factor. Aspirin use over the last 7 days. That's a risk factor. That increases the risk on these patients. More than one episode of chest pain in the 24 hours. So they may have a patient who has chest pain relieved. They were improved and then subsequently had another episode of chest pain. So think about in that kind of patient. That patient would probably benefit from an early invasive approach rather than a conservative approach. On examination, you will be looking for JVP elevation, rails, new murmurs, for example, mitral regurgitation murmur, as we were talking about earlier. Neurological symptoms. So they may show you a complex case where the patient presents with a new CVA and an echocardiogram or an EKG that suggests extensive anterior infarction. So think about in that patient, they may have an apical thrombus and that is a cause of their CVA. So EKG, this is the cornerstone of diagnosis and treatment pathways. ST elevation, acute reperfusion is recommended, greater than 0.1 millivolt in two contiguous leads, new left bundle branch block, they may tell you about that. There are some criteria for patients with old left bundle branch block and how we diagnose myocardial infarction in those patients, also with pacemakers, but remember the new left bundle branch block, true posterior myocardial infarction where there is ST depression in V1 to V4, tall R waves in the right precordial leads and upright T waves. Also the other ones that they may ask you on your examination, this is a classic type of questions, RV infarctions. So remember that in those ST elevation myocardial infarction patients. So patient presents with inferior wall myocardial infarction. So inferior wall myocardial infarction, also they may show you an EKG. So the key thing to remember there, if you have ST elevation in lead 3 greater than lead 2, that's probably your right coronary artery. And in those patients, they may have an EKG for you that has V4R. And if you have ST elevation in V4R, that is RV involvement. And in those patients, they may give you an option that give this patient nitroglycerin, and this is contraindicated in RV if the patient is having an RV infarction because they may have hypotension. So avoid in those patients. As far as EKG, as I said, the inferior wall, the lead 3 and lead 2, and they may have that. So you have the segmental myocardial infarctions, you have the posterior, which we just talked about, the true posterior myocardial infarction, but it's usually along with inferior wall myocardial infarction involving the right coronary artery. And then you have the circumflex, which is the lateral anterior wall myocardial infarction, which is throughout the precordial leads, V1 through V3 enter septal, and then the anterolateral V4 through V6. One of the other ones that you may want to keep in mind is if you see ST elevation in AVR, if you see that, that's a sign that the patient may have left main stenosis, high-grade left main stenosis. So keep that in mind. So if you see diffuse ST depression, which is really a sign of diffuse ST segment depression, if you see ST elevation in AVR, that the patient may have left main, high-grade left main stenosis. Let's keep going. Okay, so this is the one I was talking about, the inferior wall myocardial infarction. You may have an EKG like that. You have reciprocal changes in the lateral leads, inferior leads, you have ST elevation. This may be an EKG that you may see. This patient may have a high-grade LAD stenosis. You can see the deep T-wave inversions in the anterior leads. And this, they may have EKGs where one EKG was normal and then in a subsequent EKG has those changes. So that's where it's very important, even clinically, we get several EKGs because initial EKGs may be non-diagnostic. Here's another STEMI EKG inferiorly and laterally. So in these patients, we used to look at myoglobin, CKMB, but troponin has pretty much replaced that. We don't even look at the other ones. This is the preferred biomarker. Specificity and sensitivities increase in comparison to CKMB. Okay, so reperfusion strategy, as I was talking about, the thrombolytic therapy. Now, they may have a question for you. If you see anything that says give half a dose of TPA and give half a dose of some sort of 2B3 inhibitor, do not pick that choice. So they may trick you on that one. So this is a kind of a common thing that they like to use. Fibrinolytic therapy. They may ask you some questions about fibrinolytic therapy because it's still around the world. There's a lot of patients who are getting that. Fibrinolytic therapy should be, as I said, administered within 30 minutes. The success rate is about 70%. There's those patients should undergo angiography, but that's a class 2A indication. They will probably not going to ask you about that. They will ask you about adjuvant medical therapy in these patients. And the one that you should keep in mind, do not use IV beta blockers in these patients, unless the patient is quite hypertensive, they're unable to take oral medications or something like that. Use oral beta blocker, use aspirin and another antiplatelet agent. If you're using thrombolytic therapy, you will use most of the time clopidogrel and then the antithrombotic regimen. There, to keep in mind, outside of the STEMI patient, if you're going to be treating non-ST elevation myocardial infarction patient, your enoxaparin or fondaparinux are the preferred agents over unfractionated heparin, so they may ask you about that one. If you're treated interventionally, use unfractionated heparin and use intra-procedural bivalirudin. So if there's a patient non-ST elevation myocardial infarction that I'm taking to the cardiac catheterization lab, most of the time I'm using bivalirudin If there's some sort of a delay, then we're going to be using unfractionated heparin, and you'd want to avoid enoxaparin because there is an increased risk of bleeding in these patients at the catheter site because it's a strong, more potent anticoagulant that cannot be reversed. And the reperfusion strategy, STEMI patients, the first 2 to 3 hours is the greatest benefit. Now, the patient that you want to keep in mind, that you want to think about transferring to a PCI-capable hospital, they may show have a case like this. Patient presenting with cardiogenic shock, patient presenting late, patient is over the age of 75. Those are the patients who are going to be at a high risk for bleeding complications, with especially intracerebral bleeding, with the use of TPA. So those are the kind of things that you want to keep in mind when you're looking at the clinical vignette. Okay, so there are several agents. As I was saying, device time, you wanna have less than 120 minutes. Door to needle time, less than 30 minutes. 90 minutes patency, 75% to 85%. TIMI 3 flow, which is basically looking at the quality of the blood flow we achieve, is about 50% to 60%. TNK is the advantage of the TNK there is that it has a lower incidence of intracerebral bleeding in comparison to the other agents. It's easier to administer. ACC AHA guidelines, patients with cardiogenic shock or severe heart failure should be transferred immediately to a PCI-capable hospital for intervention. So keep that in mind. So this is primary PCI. In Chicago, you know, I have never even used fibrinolytic therapy. We have so many hospitals, but still worldwide, there is a significant population of patients who are treated with fibrinolytic therapy, so they may ask you some questions. Antiplatelets, clopidogrel, if you're using Lytics, 300 milligrams clopidogrel, 600 milligrams is the loading dose for PCI. Newer agents, prasugrel, ticagrelor, for patients with CVA or TIA or age greater than 75 and weight less than 60 kilograms, avoid prasugrel. Ticagrelor can be used in all patients with acute coronary syndrome, regardless of the treatment strategy, whether you use interventional approach or if the patient needs medical management, and they should be continued for a minimum of 1 year in these patients. So remember, these patients, when they're going home, whether they had an intervention or not, they should be going home on dual antiplatelet therapy. Per the guidelines now, the ticagrelor is preferred over clopidogrel. Primary PCIs, we talked about the unfractionated heparin, bivalirudin, Lytics, unfractionated heparin, low molecular, and also fondaparinux. I was talking about this, door in to door out time. So rescue angioplasty, emergent PCI after a failed fibrinolysis, cardiogenic shock, severe heart failure, ongoing ischemia, ST elevation at 90 minutes. Delayed invasive management, routine early cath after lytic treatment in all patients. It's class 2A. They're not going to ask you about that. So fibrinolytics are not indicated in non-ST elevation myocardial infarction, so keep that in mind. So if they show you a patient, do not pick the fibrinolytic treatment. Angioplasty invasive strategy, and we talked about which patients should undergo. There's also a Gray score. So there are several scores, but basically the higher the risk of the presentation, the greater the benefit for PCI. Okay, what about medical treatment? So For non-ischemic ischemic myocardial infarction, I have a mnemonic that I use. It's called SAAB, S-A-A-B, like the car. Statin, aspirin, ACE, beta blocker. And now you can add an antiplatelet agent also on top of that, for another antiplatelet agent, clopidogrel or ticagrelor. So invasive strategies, I don't think they will ask you, there's a lot of controversy in the interventional world as far as, which one is better, 2B3A, unfractionated heparin, bivalirudin. We used to use bivalirudin because of the several trials. The Horizon AMI trial was a big one that we were using, but then there were some newer trials that showed that unfractionated heparin may be better in certain ways. Now that we're using transradial, that really changes the way we're managing patients, because the risk of bleeding is so much less in comparison to femoral, and I do 90% plus transradial. So that has changed the way I do things. I don't think they will ask you about which agents to use, but just remember that you can use bivalirudin or you can use unfractionated heparin plus 2B3 inhibitor. Those are the treatments that you can use depending on your hospital and the clinician's preference. Medical management, I was talking about that. Low molecular weight heparins, unfractionated heparin, fondaparinux, bivalirudin if you're using the invasive approach. And key there is omit the 2B3A inhibitor if you're using bivalirudin. In the Horizons AMI trial, the benefit for bivalirudin was against unfractionated heparin plus 2B3A inhibitor. There was no benefit when the 2B3 inhibitor was used. As I said, in the most recent trials, when you're using transradial approach, that benefit for bleeding between bivalirudin, unfractionated heparin plus 2B3 inhibitor has been eliminated. Antiplatelets, 2B3 inhibitors, you have Integralin, Riopro, Aggrastat, antiplatelet therapy beyond these patients. So we talked about the clopidogrel, we talked about ticagrelor. Another one that you should remember is for prasugrel, which is Effient. It is only indicated for patients who are undergoing an invasive approach. There's not recommended for patients who are treated medically. So if you have a patient with acute coronary syndrome and they have a question, they can that you will send them home on if they did not have an invasive approach, do not use that agent, prasugrel. However, the other two agents are indicated for both medical management as well as interventional approach. Okay, so risk stratification, we talked about that. Biomarkers, BNP, acute EKG changes, new bundle branch block, patients with prior MI, patients over the age of 75, multiple coronary risk factors. Adjuvant therapy, oxygen, nitrates, morphine, STEMI is class 1, unstable angina, and non-ischemic myocardial infarction, class 2B. Oral beta blocker, avoid IV. As I said, in the COMMIT trial, there was an increased risk of cardiogenic shock at the first day. There was, however, a decreased risk of reinfarction and ventricular fibrillation after the day one. Avoid in heart failure, patients with prolonged PR, second or third degree reblocks, asystole, and also look for, within the case, if they're talking about a patient with hypotension, tachycardia, late presentation, those are the patients who have cardiogenic shock. ACE inhibitors within 24 hours. If you are doing inpatient medicine, it's part of our quality measures that we look at. Anterior wall myocardial infarction or ejection fraction less than 40%, or heart failure, it's a class 1 indication. So remember that. So if a patient comes in and describe a case where the patient has an LAD occlusion, the patient undergoes percutaneous intervention, they may ask you what medication the patient goes home on. So ACE inhibitor should be on that. All STEMI patient is a class 2A indication. Aldosterone, keep that in mind. with ejection fraction is less than or equal to 40%, and congestive heart failure or diabetic patients. All your patients should be getting statins, but they should be high-dose statins. The ones that have been studied is atorvastatin, 80 milligrams daily in acute coronary syndrome. So any patient that comes in, no matter what dose of statin they're on, automatically, regardless of their LDL level, they all go home, from at least when I manage them, go home on a high-dose statin, atorvastatin, 80 milligrams daily, unless they have some sort of a contraindication, such as intolerance to statins and higher-dose statins in the past. NSAIDs, all are contraindicated during hospitalization for acute MI, except for aspirin. There's an increased risk of death, reinfarction, hypertension, congestive heart failure, and cardiac rupture. Complications of ACS, electrical instability, hemodynamic instability slash shock, congestive heart failure, depressed LV function, recurrent ischemia. Now, they may ask you some questions about inferior wall myocardial infarction. Majority of the times when I see in these patients electrical instability, these are non-permanent types of electrical instability. So patients may have complete heart block, and after reperfusion, majority of the times they do resolve. Now, in patients with anterior wall myocardial infarction that is extensive, when they present with conduction abnormalities, usually these are more serious, especially if they're presenting late and there's a significant amount of myocardium that has been affected by the anterior wall myocardial infarction. Recurrent ischemia is complications, depressed LV function, they may have congestive heart failure. We talked about ischemic mitral regurgitation, so think about those patients who have a posterior medial papillary muscle rupture. In those patients, they can have acute myocardial infarction. Have seen a few of those. You can have a myocardial rupture, free wall rupture, RV infarct, and we've had a few of those as well. And the treatment of that treatment is with fluids, especially if they're hypotensive. Complication treatment, intra-aortic balloon pump, cardiocatheterization, heart failure patients, as I said, transfer those patients, especially if they're in a non-PCI-capable hospital. Pump failure, acute myocardial infarction, VST, free wall rupture. So this is what I was talking about, hypotension, JVD, and clear lungs. That's how they're going to give you the clinical presentation. Volume, catecholamines are the treatment, early reperfusion. It does decrease your, worsens your prognosis. Electrical complication, Brady and tachyarrhythmias. We talked about this earlier in another one of the talks. If you have a ventricular arrhythmias happening within the first 48 hours, those are, you know, don't treat those. After 48 hours, patient has significant ventricular arrhythmias, and those can be lethal, especially if they have sustained ventricular tachycardia. So prognosis depends on the extent of the myocardial necrosis. And as I was telling, if there's an extensive myocardial necrosis, especially in your anterior wall myocardial infarction patients, those are the patients who are going to end up with a permanent pacemaker. And so look for bundle branch block, asystole, right bundle plus a fascicular block, Mobitz type 2, complete heart blocks, 30-degree blocks. Okay, so we talked about that. And some of the things to remember. So your patients who have low ejection fractions, we talked about ICDs, so there's a waiting period for 90 days in patients for recovery of ejection fraction. So prophylactic ICD, greater than 90 days. If they have New York Heart Association, less than New York Heart Association 1 symptoms and EF less than 30% and 35% in New York Heart Association class 2 and class 3. So we can evaluate by echocardiogram. We can also do a MUGA scan. There are times when patients have an ejection fraction that are 35 to 40% range, and in that case, a MUGA scan may be indicated, so keep that in mind. Ischemia, stress testing, submaximal pre-discharge, symptom-limited early post-discharge, risk of ischemia, are patients with low ejection fraction, ventricular and electrical instability. Okay, I'm gonna run through some of these quickly. Talked about the aldosterone antagonist. Keep that in mind, that was the EPHESUS trial. ACE inhibitors, aspirin, beta blockers, warfarin, anticoagulation, extensive anterior wall myocardial infarction, LV thrombus, clopidogrel for all patients with ACS, cardiac rehab.